and welcome to the Diabetic Show. My name is Mark Philwett, type 1 since 1987.
Dobie Maxwell, riding sidecar, ashamed, but he'd be type 2. No, actually, we're learning here. We're welcoming you to the show where we take a diabetes type 1 and type 2 and delve into it and make ourselves a community for those who have it or know people who have it.
Or need it. The website, thediabeticshow.com, the Facebook, get there, search The Diabetic Show, you'll find us. And, of course, the email. Mark with a K at thediabeticshow.com.
Dobie without a K, D-O-B-I-E, also at thediabeticshow.com. If you have any questions, and people are sending in questions, we have fun on the show, but we don't ever take your questions for granted. People want to know things. We have experts. We know people. If you have a question, we'll be glad to pass it along.
Very good.
Get it answered.
I have a special guest today on the show, Director of Communications at BeyondType1.org, as well as a person living with type 1 diabetes herself, Dana Howell. And she'll be in a little bit later on. Dana writes more editorial-based stories, but, boy, she came up with one about the price of insulin.
Yeah, she's from a younger generation, but she's got a spark, and she's really interesting, and we want to have her in the circle on the team.
Very good.
She'll be good. We have a what's in the news, diabetic.
Gosh. Well, the one story really jumps out. Well, the life expectancy in the U.S. has declined for the first time ever this last year.
For diabetics or for anybody?
No, in all. The total life expectancy of the U.S. down one full month over last year.
Okay. Hopefully it's a cold month.
So anyway, they're saying diabetes might be one of the reasons why people are dying.
So this is like the average of the collective.
Yeah. Fatter population. Uh-huh. You know, those kids today. Go by the playgrounds, they're empty. Yeah. That's why.
Okay.
Fat kids. Did I offend anybody yet? Let's move on. Type 2 diabetes, let's get to the story. I know we got to take the break here, get Dana on here. But it comes out with a story from Yale, the JAMA Institute. Type 1, type 2 diabetic people, diabetic people that have insulin requirements, they're making decisions to take less insulin just so they can make it to the next insulin injection or however they take
it. Okay. So it's becoming a financial thing.
Out-of-pocket expenses apparently through the roof. So I'm sure we'll be talking. Well, that's the entire interview, actually.
So it's like the basic needs: food, clothing, shelter. You got to add insulin. We've got now four basic needs.
Yeah.
Food, clothing, shelter, insulin,
and the air. Air is going to get you. Watch next.
The next World War IV will be fought over water.
Let's take the break here. The Diabetic Show. Thanks so much for listening.
He's Mark. I'm Dobie. Thank you for listening. Important guest upcoming.
And welcome back to the Diabetic Show. Mark Philwett, type 1, proudly stricken since 1987.
Dobie Maxwell, riding sidecar, type 2, but still involved in the process. Glad to be here.
Yes, he is part of the disease, and we're glad to have
him. I almost feel like I'm not worthy. You know, you sit around diabetics, and, you know, when I'm in civilians, ooh, you're a type 2. You got to. With type 1s, it's like I'm the puppy.
Well, we do refer to you as the junior diabetic.
You'd think we'd have our own name for a disease, but we have to type 1, type 2. It's like a sequel in a movie.
And we've talked about this so many times in the past. It's really two completely different diseases. Mm-hmm. Really. I mean, not even nephews. So it deals with not being able to eat.
It's like when my grandpa as a kid told me the difference between bacon and eggs. The chicken was involved. The pig was committed. He had to give it all up. Same thing. You know, the pancreas is involved in type 2, but type 1, the pancreas is committed.
And you know, of course, any complaints should be directed to the website. You reminded me of that. Thediabeticshow.com. Facebook.
Facebook group. We have fives of. Actually, we have more than fives. We have people.
Tens of.
Now we have an exciting guest, and we have a new outlet for interesting people who can tell stories about type 1 and type 2.
Well, before we were talking to a lot of people possessing the disability. Mm-hmm. I'll call it a disability. Why not? Mm-hmm. Can't really park closer. But now we have people who are actually moving the bar and talking about things that diabetics, type 1, type 2, type 1.5, whatever, we still haven't figured out.
There's going to be a type 3. You know there is.
You know, it's a matter of time. Anyway, enough of the banter. Dana, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
She's a brave brave guest, Dana Howe. Dana is the Director of Communications at BeyondType1.org, as well as a person living with type 1 diabetes. So, Dana, thank you for coming out. And I'll tell you, I say thank you because a lot of people have hung up after the first 30 seconds of the intro. So you're in the minority. So thanks for sticking around.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm really honored to be here.
I was waiting for that click. Sorry about that. But now, Dana, the way I came across Dana Howe's work is as I'm getting all the information going here for the show, different fact-finding. Mm-hmm. Dana writes these stories, at least the ones I've had. Sorry, the computers are making noise. How do you shut them up? That's how you shut them up. So Dana writes for BeyondType1.org. Now, Dana, of the stories that you've written, two that really came out to my ears or eyes, one had to do with a human insulin not being the answer. And then we'll touch on that. But, boy, the one story Dana has about the cost of insulins. Mm-hmm. And how many times we've talked about this in the past.
They're not getting cheaper.
No, they are not. Now, Dana, if you give us a couple seconds here, I'd like to get the audience up to speed because we've done all this research on the history of insulin over the years here. 1921, discovery of insulin, thanks to Banting and Best. The one was orthopedic surgeon and a student, I believe. And Dana, by the way, if you know anything about the history of diabetes or insulin, feel free to pop in because I could be wrong. I made a career out of it. So, but 1921, they discover the insulin. And then also, the most incredible part was after they discovered insulin, they gave the patent, actually two patents, to the country of Canada. Would I be correct on that, Dana?
Yeah, I think there might have been three patents. I think there's one more with Banting and Best. But the important part of the story is that they sold the patent for $1 each.
$1. And why would they have done something so ridiculous, Dana?
Oh, I'm going to misquote our favorite guy, Frederick Banting, right now.
Go right ahead.
That he recognized that insulin was more important than the money that he could potentially make off of it. There's a quote from him that's like, this should belong to the world, because he saw the life-saving potential that it had.
And it truly, well, it had to take off, being the only medication for the disease, but it worked just the way they wanted it to. It got in the hands of people who needed it. It didn't really matter how much they made, because at such a low cost, they were able to get the insulin into them. And, of course, the life expectancies stretch out from, boy, I mean, we talked about this before. If you had diabetes in the 20s, well, that was it. I mean, what, a few months maybe?
Yeah, not good. There were some starvation diets pre-therapeutic insulin where people could maybe live for another year. Mm. There's some really excellent storytelling around that about the first patients who were injected with insulin and how absolutely revolutionary that was in terms of taking people from the brink of death, literally, to, able to live relatively normal lives. So it's kind of this miracle drug that we don't see that often in health sciences and in research and discovery. And it's like such a wonderful story because it was so crazy, the change from just even the first injection of insulin.
So they sold the patents to Canada, $1 a piece. Everybody's getting the insulin. But now let's fast forward a good, almost 100 years coming up, 98. So $85 billion in insulin sales. I get kind of confused on the numbers because they make the numbers very cloudy, at least with the research that I've been doing, Dana. You don't really know because the total amount spent on diabetes is $100 billion. So, but they kind of divide it up as far as the blood monitors, all the accessories of the disease. But just concentrating on insulin, still multi-billion-dollar industry. How does it go from a dollar for a patent to tens of billions of dollars in a short 100 years?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think there's not one easy answer to that problem. I think what we can all agree on is that it's too expensive now. It is that way for probably a variety of reasons. And I think to add layers of complexity, it's not uniform around the world. So I think I read recently that half of the people who are insulin dependent in the world don't have reliable access to insulin that they need. But that could be a really different situation for someone in the United States, outside the United States. So the price of insulin isn't uniform, but access is a major issue, and the price is high, and that's part of the why access is such an issue.
Well, now, in your article, as far as, well, you know, we had this great format. We were talking before the show. Well, Dana, I want to discuss this, then discuss this. As you can tell, Dana, that formula is out the window now. So let's just
stammer
through these next two breaks as best as we can. Because it is the point with the insulin and the availability of it and the costs of it. I pulled something up from JAMA over these last couple of days. Apparently, the cost of insulin and the decisions people are making whether they want to use insulin or, I don't know, eat. These stories are now fresh and new all of a sudden. Apparently, this is what I got from JAMA from this morning. I'm not sure if you've seen this story yet. One quarter of the patients, and this is just in this country, one quarter of the patients with type 1 or type 2 diabetes, they're using less insulin than prescribed simply because of the costs of the insulin.
Yes, I have seen that study. It's been in the news a lot, and I'm really happy to see it in the news a lot. There's a lot of great advocates and organizations doing the work to kind of get that next level of awareness about insulin pricing. And this study has gotten major traction outside of the diabetes world, which I'm really happy to see that as a first step.
Okay, well, let me give you a little bit of the history for me. The year pops in my head for some reason, 1995. I was out of insulin. I had no insulin on me. It's funny, something you do 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day, you forget to do. You ever happened to you, Dana? You know, the injection.
Yeah, I can relate.
It's weird. So I'm out there, no insulin whatsoever. I'm able to walk into a Walgreens back then. No prescription. They gave me R, which at that time, R was the fast acting and was the longer acting. Mm-hmm. And that whole vial cost me $19. In $1,995. But still, fast forward today, I'm using these little pens, and it's not really a full vial anymore. The pens are kind of maybe about a third, wouldn't you say, Dana? If you're using a pen for injection of insulins, it's about a third of a vial, give or take.
That seems like a reasonable estimate. Yeah. Don't quote me, but it's less.
And don't quote any of us. We're simply discussing here. But the point being, that insulin pen, just a third of that, was like $300 and almost $400 for a pen. Would you like a syringe with that? Would you like something you can screw on the top of that pen that makes it functional?
Yeah.
Well, that's another $30, $40, depending on how you get your stickums.
Well, can I jump in and just say, I think it's important in these moments to note, in case there is anyone listening to this that is having trouble affording insulin and might be rationing insulin. The R insulin that you were talking about, which is a human insulin, an older type of insulin, probably not an analog insulin that you might be using now. There are human insulins that are the older types of insulin still available in most states without a prescription necessary. If you go into even a Walmart or your pharmacy and ask about R and NPH, you can oftentimes find them for about $25 a bottle. So in emergency situations, I think that we have a duty to plug that because it will sustain life. But you are going to pay a lot more than that for probably the insulin that your doctor is prescribing you. So obviously this is a problem. It's not ideal. But PSA, if there are people out there who are currently finding themselves without insulin, go get the older insulin if it's a matter of no insulin or human insulin.
It's a bridge. I did that on vacation last year, and you're right. I think I went to Walmart, $28. Of course, the syringes. They always look at you weird when you're buying a syringe, especially when you got the insulin right next to you. But, so that definitely, I don't know. It depends on the person, again, whether it's going to be the best insulin for you. But I know in the 90s, it was all you had. So, yeah, I guess it'll get you through. At least it did for me for the night for the fast acting stuff.
I think the point for me is it's not good enough. Like, it's not a solution, and we shouldn't be going backwards in terms of standard of care because of the cost. But if you're in a pinch and you need insulin and you're not going to pay $400, just know that that's an option.
Exactly. And also a lot of the pharmacies or the pharmacies, rather, the big pharmacies, pharma, there are programs. So Lilly has one, Sanofi has one, they all have them. It's just you have to be the proactive one to drag that insulin out of their pocket. I tell you what.
A lot of hoops to jump through with those, but they do exist. Good to know.
Let's take the break right here, Dana. We'll settle it up. And then we'll come back. We'll discuss about, I want to hit definitely the difference between, look, you were saying the two different insulins, analog, human. Boy, it gets kind of complicated if you let it.
Yeah.
So we'll come back. We'll be talking to Dana Howe, Director of Communications at beyondtype1.org. Oh, and I definitely want to hit on that site. We'll talk about that when we come right back. Huh? The Diabetic Show. And welcome back to the Diabetic Show. I'm Mark Philwett, Type 1 Diabetic.
I'm Dobie Maxwell, Type 2. We have a very distinguished guest from the left coast. No, I'm not talking about La Crosse. It's here in Wisconsin. Ouch. We're talking about Northern California. Dana, could you share a little bit about your own story? I think you sound like a young person, and Type 1 is always a life-changing experience. How were you diagnosed?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have had Type 1 for, I think, 16 going on 17 years.
Wow, you're a lifer.
I was diagnosed when I was 8. So you can do the math and find out how old I am. I think that
we're not trying to tell. That's rude to ask a woman how old she is. How much do you weigh?
How much she weighs? We can ask her that. Yeah, there you go.
Because you're healthy.
No, but I actually was diagnosed into a family with some Type 1 diabetics already in the mix, which I think really defined how I grew up with it. Mm-hmm. My dad is Type 1. He is now in his 60s. He's had Type 1 for 50 years. And then to add to that, my mom's dad, so my maternal grandfather, unrelated to my dad, also lives with Type 1. He is in his 80s now and has also had Type 1 for over 50 years.
Wow.
So,
very good.
I had the privilege of kind of joining the ranks of a family of people with Type 1, which I think gave me a unique perspective on what that means. But when I went to college, moved out of living with my family, I missed having a community that I had kind of baked in and started looking for that and realized how different people's stories with diabetes are and how important having that community can be, and that's sort of what brought me to be on Type 1.
Well, I bet your family meals as a kid were all pretty much buttoned down. If you had people that were like your dad and your grandpa, you were eating well on your holiday meals. You were going over.
Yeah.
Portion control.
Well, we eat a lot. I mean, don't get me wrong, but my mom
lots of kale.
15 minutes before the meal would be like, "All right, everybody, come and dress. Time for dinner in 15 minutes." So that was always fun. Feeling like a part of something rather than feeling like, oh, I'm the only one and there's something wrong with me.
Interesting.
You know, that's really interesting. I think, you're taking blood sugar measurements on the turkey on Thanksgiving.
Wow.
The turkey's hypoglycemic, more cranberries. So now, if it help people that don't know where to go, because I had no one else in my family that had, I was diagnosed with type 2, and nobody else, they said at the hospital, "Was anybody else in your family diabetic?" I said, "No, they all had cancer and they deserved it." You know, I was joking. they looked at me like I was a monster or something like that. I said, "Well, I am a comedian. I don't know if you knew that. I'm a stand-up comedian by trade." And it's one of those things where that's one of the least funny things that you can hear is that you have a major disease. So we're trying to make it – we don't make fun, but we have fun, and we keep it light because it's a big thing for people who don't have anywhere to go. So we appreciate what you do and your website because I think people need to go in and have their own pseudo-family.
Well, you know, Dana, you touched on the fact that, I mean, you were surrounded by diabetes. I mean, you're surrounded by DNA just to try to get at you. And you had that support system in place, which was nice. And as a matter, I'm sure you were a support system for them before you got it. So what do you tell people? Because here's the one thing we get from doing the show. They think they're alone. They think they're the only one that might have whatever problem we're discussing. Yet we all share it. We really do. We just might not be around to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for me, the internet has blown this wide open. I think your show is a great example of building community at every level. I'm now the director of communications at Beyond Type 1, and Beyond Type 1 is a young organization that has really jumped on the communities and started building the communities of people impacted by diabetes on the internet and creating a home base for people who might really be the only person in their small town that they know, but they can now get online, get on social media, and immediately connect with other people who are going through the same thing.
Now that
so that's part of what we do at Beyond Type 1.
I was going to say, let me give you the – let's get the website out of the way. It's beyondtype1.org.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Continue on, because you provide a community.
Yeah. So we are using our website and our social media platforms, actually started as an Instagram campaign. So follow Instagram.com/BeyondType1. We're sharing stories from people who have type 1 diabetes every day. And from there, we became a nonprofit organization, and we've started running programs both online and in person that really all offer pragmatic solutions to the problems that people impacted by diabetes have, while also helping build community and find, like, allow people to find their place in the, we focus on type 1 diabetes community. So a couple examples of those programs that have built out of that, we realized that the internet isn't really a great place for kids to connect necessarily, so we started a pen pal club called the Snail Mail Club. So kids with type 1 can sign up and get connected with a pen pal anywhere in the world. That's, you know, one program. We also are working with a new program called Safe Sittings, where we're helping families find babysitters who have type 1 diabetes or understand type 1 diabetes for their child with type 1, because it can be really hard to find care.
Those are all cool, even if you don't have diabetes. I love those programs anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea, right? Is like pragmatic solutions to problems we have that come out of the needs that the diabetes community faces.
Now, I don't know if you knew, but my co-host Mark is up for a transplant, a pancreas transplant, which I think is going to make fascinating broadcasting. Just not because he's my partner and he's nuttier than a fruitcake, and I mean that with love.
With love.
But it's fascinating. I think that for someone else to go through it would take some of the fear away and know that it's possible. And it's amazing. We are in – I know you're young and you were around technology your whole life. We're old. This is like George Jetson for us, all this new technology and new ways to measure insulin. It's fascinating, and it gives people hope like yourself and your generation.
Yeah, I think that like the number of people that I know with type 1 diabetes because of social media and because of the internet has really changed what it means for me to be living with type 1. And also just changes your perspective about what it means in general for anyone. But knowing that I have people who get it, who I can just post something on an Instagram story about the bad blood sugar day I'm having, and that resonates with people who reach out and are like, hey, I've been there. That is really, really powerful. And it makes me really hopeful too. I think it's something good coming out of social media. I think we like to, hate on social media and millennials a lot, but being part of something that's having a real impact in people's lives because of the ways that we can build connections online is important.
Now, Dana, your article I wanted to touch on with the price of insulin. I'm one of the fortunate to have insurance. Even with insurance, mm-hmm. I'm paying about $1,200 a year, heavily mm-hmm. discounted to only $1,200 a year for my insulin. Your article. There, I don't know, did you come up with a number, or you pulled the number from some report that said the actual cost of that insulin, $130, $150? Can you fill me in a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So there are a couple caveats to this study, but there was a study that was done at, it was at an Ivy League institution, let me tell you. Yes, I'm looking at it now. It was at the Harvard T. Chan School of Public Health, where they looked at the numbers, and the goal of these researchers was to try to figure out what a reasonable price of a biosimilar insulin, so we're going to get a little technical, but it was low. It was between $78 and $130 U.S. dollars per person per year.
Per person per year. For every single unit of insulin they need to find another year, that price. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And this was for modern analog insulins, the ones that are so expensive.
Right.
But what the study assumed, really what this tells us is we're far away from that number right now.
Yeah.
And it points out some of the reasons why that's not the price of insulin right now. And it is complicated, and there are multiple groups that are involved in making that happen. So in order for that number to be true, the study assumed that there is a competitive market of biosimilar insulins, which means many more types of insulin that all kind of do the same thing.
But there aren't.
Biosimilar insulin is like, we take Humalog, it's a fast-acting insulin. A biosimilar to Humalog that doesn't at this time exist would have another different brand name, but would do basically the same thing as Humalog. But the competition in the market with a healthy biosimilar market would be one piece of driving down the price of insulin.
But you hit
other
it.
Thing, sorry.
No, really I'm sorry quick. To interrupt. I'm sorry to interrupt yeah. you. You hit it right the on the head. Thing. It's the competition yeah. that does not exist.
Yeah, and then the other thing that doesn't exist that this assumes, or doesn't exist in the United States, I should say, that this assumes, is these prices were based on if your biosimilar insulin manufacturer was negotiating a price for the insulin directly with a government.
Yeah, and that's like, where it gets sticky. Exactly what you were saying. It's a very sticky, very layered argument that we're talking about here. But but you know, if you pull away all the stickum, it's still... I'm sorry, maybe just the older I get, the more pessimistic I get, Dana. But, you know, until I start seeing conventions held in Fargo, North Dakota, as opposed to Miami or Vegas or San Diego, research and development is a real muddy term as far as what does that dollar go to? But anyway, I know. Oh, hold on, Troy. I've been rambling here. How much we're rolling along?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, I knew what would happen, Dana. I knew the minute I found you that we would run into this, that the time isn't long enough here.
Hopefully you'd be willing to come back. We'd love to have you. Very interesting stuff.
Well, if there's – we got a couple minutes here. What do you want to get out? What is the message of all this we're doing today? What is the one thing you want people to walk away with?
I think for me, and I can – like you said, there's some pessimism, and I think the reason that I've been – driven to write these editorials for Beyond Type 1 that are really personal. Like, they're my opinions and point of view as a person living with diabetes who also happens to work in the diabetes industry. The numbers are a grabby headline, but for me, they put into sharp relief the work that there's to be done on insulin access and some of the things we can try to advocate for to really get there. And I think that for me, we want to see a world where there is universal access to insulin. I think that insulin access should be a human right. And looking at studies like this that suggest things like we need an active competition market, we need more regulation, and we need to, there are some other advocacy things, like advocating for transparency at every level of the supply chain, really understanding what the supply chain in the United States looks like, and starting to think about where we can regulate that. These are big problems that no one organization or one group is going to be able to necessarily accomplish. It brings into play our political system, our health insurers, major manufacturers, pharmacy benefit managers, patients, advocates, nonprofits. And for me, it's just like there's a lot of work to be done here, but it needs to be done because, you know, it's affecting people's lives. It's taking people's lives. And I hope that starting with understanding the problem, starting with transparency, and starting with the system in the United States as it currently stands can lead us to solutions.
Dana Howe.
Hopefully we did that. Dana Howe, our very distinguished special guest. Her website, BeyondType1, that is the number one, .org. And we really appreciate you being with us, and we're just hopefully scratching the surface with you. Now we have a friendly connection on the left coast, and we look forward to talking to you again. No sugar tonight in my tea. No sugar.